I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We all endured math and science classes that we thought we'd never use later in life. And yet there have probably been times you wished you paid a little more attention as you end up solving a problem in a longer and harder way. Today, Randall Monroe is here to demonstrate how even outrageous solutions can teach us. The creator of the popular comic strip XKCD has a complicated solution bound to surpass anything you've ever tried. We'll ask the best-selling author why he's traded his job at NASA for drawing stick figure self-help guides. But the really burning question is, why use cheese to build a pool? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. The idea behind Randall Monroe's latest book, How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems, is to examine unusual approaches to everyday challenges, like digging a hole or hosting a pool party. Along the way, Monroe examines a lot of options, some of which are more than just a little improbable, like ordering bottled water from Amazon to fill your new swimming pool at a cost of $250,000. The idea is that along the way, you learn something about real science, as we're about to do right now. Randall Monroe has a degree in physics and worked at NASA's Langley Research Center before turning to comics and writing books full-time. His online strip is XKCD, where he uses stick figures to discuss modern life. His books include What If and Thing Explainer that sold over 1 million copies and earned him fans such as Bill Gates and Elon Musk. He speaks in town tonight. More on that in a moment. It's so good to have you, Randall. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've got these bestsellers under your belt, the big online comic strip. How good is life right now for you?
Oh, it's been really cool, especially meeting people who have read my book, and especially if they know something really cool that I didn't know about. That's one of my favorite parts of it all.
And they stump you sometimes with that, eh?
Oh, all the time. Absolutely. I love just learning all the cool stuff that people know. Everyone has something weird or interesting to tell you.
I mean, did you ever in a million years foresee all this happening to you? Was this sort of in your life's map of what you wanted to do someday?
No, I mean, I remember thinking when I was a little kid, I read a lot of comics and I thought, hey, drawing a comic seems like a great deal. But then I thought, well, I only know how to draw stick figures. And so I don't know if that maybe that rules that out. But it turned out not to be as much of an impediment as I thought, I guess.
Well, what made you think that? Because most folks would think they wouldn't even try a comic strip if they couldn't draw characters like Charles Schulz did.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really trying to start a comic. I would just be doodling in my notebooks when I was sitting in class. You know, I wasn't always the best student. And so at some point I thought, hey, I could, some of these things, if I draw a box around them, they're kind of, you know, I think this one's kind of funny or these are kind of neat. I'm gonna put some of them on my website and see if anyone, you know, I can show them to my friends and stuff. And then before I knew it, the people were passing them around and started wanting to know if they could get, you know, a print or a T-shirt or something.
Was there a moment when you began to think this seems to be working?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, every step was a surprise. I was working at the NASA Langley Research Center on a contract basis. And so when one of my contracts ran out, and they didn't renew it, but they were like, here, do you want another contract? I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll call them back, but I think I'm going to see about this comics thing just for a little bit and see how that works. And then I've been doing that ever since.
How much trepidation did you have taking that leap off the proverbial bridge of life?
I don't know. I felt like it was all such a surprise that, like, you know, to me it was a dream to work at NASA, and it was a dream to be doing comics on the internet. Like, those both seemed too good to be true. So I just kind of was waiting to see how far each one went.
How has all this changed things for you? Changed your life?
I don't really know. I feel like I've just been really lucky that I've been able to pursue this stuff that I wanted to, you know, and that's to learn about stuff. I know that when I was doing physics, one of the things that worried me was I felt like I really had to drill into one topic and stick to that and become the expert in that topic. But I always jumped around a lot. And I feel like I got really lucky that I stumbled on a career where I can every week learn about something new and, you know, dig into that a little bit and then move on to the next thing.
I was going to say, you're still jumping around a lot, because I've got to ask, where do you come up with this stuff? Throwing a pool party and filling the pool by buying bottled water from Amazon, you suggest that in your latest book, How To, or trying to answer the question, could you build a jetpack using downward firing machine guns? I mean, you're working this stuff.
Yeah, I'm always trying to. I'm someone who always has a task, and then I think I have an idea for how to do this. Now, it might sound like a bad idea, but it sounds like a lot of work, but it'll save time in the long run, and it never does. But I usually learn something interesting when I try it.
I mean, are people suggesting these ideas to you, or are you coming up with the idea yourself? I mean, you talk in the book about the challenge of moving a household, and at one point you're talking about putting all your boxes in front of a big truck and literally pushing them down the road as one way to maybe save some time.
Yeah, a lot of the time it's not even that I'm trying to think of a bad idea or trying to think of a good idea. I'm just thinking of different ways of doing it. And then I love that you can use math and research and physics to try to figure out, would that idea work or not? Because I'm always a little curious, because sometimes they surprise you.
Yeah. The PR materials for this book describe it as ultimately a useless self-help guide full of highly impractical advice for everything from landing a plane to digging a hole. I mean, should I offer you my congratulations given that kind of buildup?
Yeah, I think that even when an idea isn't helpful for the task at hand, often you learn something that'll help you with some other task later on. But even if it's not useful, and it's never useful, I think seeing how these things can go wrong can just be a lot of fun.
When you show your manuscripts to your friends or whatever, your wife, I mean, do they think you're crazy? I mean, they think, what are you trying to push here, Randall? This isn't going to work.
Honestly, what I love about people I know is that often they'll make the idea even more ridiculous. I had an idea about building a lava moat around a house and to keep out ants and garden pests. And one of my friends who was doing fact checking it said, you know, you're going to have all these updrafts from the lava moat. Maybe you could sell balloon rides to people using that to try to recoup some of the costs.
And along the way, you learn something about science. That's the whole idea here,
exactly.
I think. Randall Munroe is my guest. His new book, How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems. We're going to come back and talk to him about how to land an airplane on a train. Can you do that or not? And welcome back. I am Steve Kraske. I'm visiting with Randall Munroe about his latest book, How To. You know, in this book, Randall, you asked an astronaut and test pilot named Chris Hadfield about all manner of emergency situations involving aircraft. One emergency landing you asked him about was, could you land an airplane on a moving train? I'm just wondering, what got you thinking about that?
Well, I usually do a lot of research on my own. I don't usually, you know, I'll try to figure out what I can solve. But now and then it is fun to reach out to someone who really knows how to do something and try to get their expertise and apply it to something that you hadn't, you know, necessarily thought about before. And so when I interviewed Colonel Hadfield, I wanted to just ask him as many different questions about strange ways, situations you might encounter if you were trying to land, and see what he would say to each one. And so I sort of started with the most ridiculous ones, or started with the least ridiculous ones, and then kind of worked my way up, figuring at some point he'd say, that's the most ridiculous question I'd ever heard, and just hang up on me.
But did he?
No. The joke was on me. I mean, I should have known better than to try to fluster a test pilot by throwing extreme, unexpected situations at them. But he just answered every question I asked.
One of them was, how do you land a plane on a submarine, which I gather would have to be on the surface? How do you land a plane on a submarine? Could you?
I mean, I couldn't.
Yeah.
Maybe Colonel Hadfield could. You got to get the plane has to have a short enough landing distance. So if it's the wrong kind of plane, you know, there's nothing you can do. But if it's a plane that can land in a relatively short distance, and you get the submarine or the ship or whatever, either of those going into the wind to get a high relative speed between the wind and the deck of the submarine or the ship. He said that then that'll help you by shortening the distance you need to land because your plane will be going more slowly. He said you can think of the submarine as a short, wet runway, but he also added that it can be hard to find a submarine when you need one.
Has that ever yeah. Has that ever happened?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think they but I was surprised by the number of things I asked him where he said, oh, yeah, people have done that. Like when I asked him about landing on a train, I thought he'd say, like, no, of course you can't do that. But he said, oh, yeah, people do that now and then. They've done it. They'll do it flatbed trucks at air shows, too. You'll see sometimes.
Yeah, I was going to say that was my next question about landing a plane on a train. How do you do that? Because you have to match the speed of the train, I'm guessing.
Or? Yeah. I mean, I'm not a pilot. So I asked him, you know, could you if you came in and you wanted to land on a train, could you just fly at the same speed as the train and then set yourself down gently on it? And I was expecting him to say, no, that's not how that works at all. But he said, yeah, you could do that. But what you got to watch out for is the train will be kind of moving up and down. And it's going to want to bounce you when you touch down. So when you touch down, you got to stay down firmly or else you'll get jostled off. And then he just kind of paused, like, all right, you got any other questions?
What else you got, buddy? Yeah. Well, I've always wondered, as I'm driving on an interstate and you come to one of those trucks with the big trailer that carries cars on it, and cars are hanging off of it. And my question always is, if there was a ramp on the back of that truck, could you drive onto the truck when you're going 70 miles an hour? And once you hit the trailer part, would you be going so fast that you'd ram into the cab of the truck? Or how would that play out? And am I catching you cold? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I feel like I've seen that in at least one action movie.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And there might, that's the kind of thing. There might be a Mythbusters or Top Gear episode where they've tried that, but yeah. I haven't seen it. I mean, I don't see why you couldn't. You might end up with a lot of your wheels spinning at, but I think you could do it. I think.
Would you have to jam on your brakes once you got on top of the trailer?
I think once you get on, you'd have your wheels. You know, if it's front wheel drive, you'd get up onto the trailer, and then your wheels, you'd immediately be slipping because you'd be going on the highway, going 60 miles an hour, your wheels in contact with the ground.
Yeah.
To then you touch the trailer, and suddenly your wheels are still going to be spinning at 60 miles an hour, but the trailer is going to be almost stationary. So you'll probably have trouble getting a grip. It's like you'll suddenly be skidding. I don't know if you'll have, some kind of anti-lock system kick in or what. But I think it'll probably be pretty bumpy the moment you move from the ground to the trailer. But your back wheels wouldn't even notice until they got up onto it as well. I think you could do it.
Well, this is really important to me, so check it out next time you come here on Up to Date. I'd appreciate that, Randall. You also asked this very probing question. Say my friend and I are flying a pair of small aircraft over a shark-filled ocean. I'm about to run out of fuel, but I have a parachute. My friend is flying alongside me. Could I get out of my plane and into theirs, then land that plane?
Yeah, that's when he said, I asked Colonel Hadfield that toward the end as I'm trying to stump him. And he said, no, if you're flying those old biplanes with the two wings, with the structures between them, people will wing walk on those. And you could walk out onto the wing of your plane and grab onto the wing of your friend's plane and step into it.
Right.
But he said, if you're thinking about jumping out with the parachute, floating down and getting caught by your friend, he said, my guess is you're shark food.
Yeah. Well, the point of all this is this practical advice is you're solving real world problems, helping people maybe even think creatively about the issues they confront. Have you had an example where something you've come across actually led to a constructive, productive solution?
Oh, I don't know. I've got all kinds of there's all kinds of cool stuff that I've learned and kinds of solutions that I always think everything in my own life is going to work until it doesn't. So the stuff that does work, I don't really think about. What's really surprised me is how much when I'm trying to come up with ridiculous ideas, I learn that that not only am I not the first one to come up with it, but someone has actually tried it, which really surprises me. I had the idea of trying to lift a house by sticking two helicopters together no one helicopter is powerful enough to lift a house. And I said, well, what about you could glue a couple helicopters together and get, twice or three times the lifting power. And I thought that was so ridiculous that I was like, you know, I think I've gone too far this time. But then I found that there's been a government study on this. The Navy, a contractor proposed this to the Navy, proposed a multi-helicopter heavy lift system.
That's
it was
really
just two of them stuck together.
We're talking with Randall Munroe, whose problem-solving approach has been described as outrageous sounding and highly impractical. Maybe you're catching that drift. And we are back. I'm visiting with Randall Munroe about his latest book, How To. He'll be speaking at 7 tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, go to rainydaybooks.com or call 913-384-3126. Let's go to another problem that you attempt to solve in this book. One of them is to how to throw a pool party. And the first issue is you got to face is, do you build an in-ground pool or an above-ground pool? And pretty soon you're evaluating the strength of cheese to serve as the wall of your above-ground pool. How did you get to cheese, Randall, to figure out that question?
Well, I started with the easy, sort of easy question of like throwing a pool party, but I always, if the answer seems too easy, I'll add some constraint. So for this one, I thought, okay, well, what if you don't have a pool and your pool party's about to start? So I started thinking, how do you construct a pool? And I was running through these options, and one of the things I did was calculate, you know, how strong does the wall of a pool have to be to hold in all that water,
mm-hmm.
which is surprisingly strong. You know, the water weighs a lot. Anyone who's tried to fill a fish tank on the ground and then lift it up to the table can tell you that. And so what I really like about physics, though, is it doesn't care whether the equations you're doing are ridiculous or not. So you can take the same equations that tells you how thick the wall of a fiberglass pool has to be. And instead of putting in fiberglass, you can put in any other material you want, and the equation still works.
Hmm.
And so I looked up, I got this book on the mechanical properties of cheeses, and I started putting in different cheeses to see how thick the cheese wall would have to be to hold the water in.
But why cheese? How does your brain manage to maneuver into that space?
I don't know. Maybe
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I just started running through all the materials, and a lot of them are normal. You know, it sounded like you can make a pool out of wood, you can make a pool out of metal, and I was like, well, what's some? You know, how? What else is there? And I just started running through everything I could think of
until
I hit on
cheese. Of course, people wonder about that. Yeah. Then there's the challenge of getting water into your pool. So naturally, you turn to the idea of buying bottled water from Amazon for $250,000. How did that cross your mind?
Well, I mean, the kind of obvious way to try to fill a pool would be if you got a hose on the back of your house, and you can do that. But sometimes the flow rate isn't high enough, even if you use, you know, and especially if you have a well, you might run into problems that way. You might not be able to fill your pool quickly enough from the well. So I thought, well, where else can you get water? You know, and so I ran through all the options I could think of, steal it from your neighbors, you know, get it from a river. And then I was like, well, if everything else fails, you know, Amazon does have same-day delivery. So,
but then you were astute enough to recognize the fact that someone would have to unscrew the caps of all those, you know, tens of thousands of bottles, and that would take a lot of time. So you began looking at ways that maybe you could circumvent that problem. Where did you go?
Yeah, I was thinking, okay, well, you got to make holes in all these bottles. You don't have time to unscrew the caps. You won't be able to fill the pool fast enough. So maybe you could cut them all in half. I was curious how easy it is to cut bottles in half. I thought you could take a sword or a machete or something. But if you go on YouTube, you can see people trying to do this, and it's a lot harder than you'd think. The bottles tend to kind of deflect it. So then I thought, you know what, there's the right way to do this is you get one of those industrial shredders that they use for recycling.
Yes.
And those things are made to separate out the liquid and discard it. But instead, you have it discard the bottles, and you just use the liquid to fill your pool. Might be some plastic bits in there, but
you also looked at the idea of opening the bottles using nuclear weapons.
Well, this is another case of where reality was way weirder than anything I could come up with.
Oh no, we're not getting in that space, are we? Yeah.
Yeah, this was an idea that sounds like completely ridiculous, but it was actually tested by the government during the Cold War. They got a bunch of soda and beer bottles from local retailers and put them out in the middle of the desert during a nuclear weapons test to see how they would fare and whether the bottles would be broken or not. And I was amazed when I came across this study because that was a wild time. There's a lot of weird research that came out of that period.
The Cold War period. Did the bottles survive intact or what did you find?
Yeah, the report said that the bottles did pretty well. And the reason they were looking at this was they were trying to test whether or not if in a post-nuclear attack, you know, cleanup situation, would the bottles in convenience stores still be drinkable as sources of hydration or would they need to bring in water from outside?
Mm-hmm.
So there is sort of of a reasonable justification for it. Although I've secretly wondered whether the whole project wasn't put together because someone was caught buying drinks on their government account.
Under the right circumstances, we're still talking about how to fill the pool. You point out you could steal the water. How would you do that?
Well, if you got someone else who has a pool uphill from yours, you can put a hose into a tube into their pool and a tube into your pool. And if you can get the tube filled with water, which is the tricky part engineering-wise, it'll start flowing under gravity on its own. It'll flow up over the side of their pool and
it's
down
a siphon,
into yours.
Right?
Yeah, all you need is a siphon.
And you point out that the siphon will only take the water up so high. There's a maximum level that the water can rise.
Yeah, siphons they always seem weird to me that water can flow uphill.
It is amazing.
And the only reason it works is air pressure. The air is pushing down on the surface of the pool that's uphill. And if you remove the, and if you try to create a vacuum inside the tube, the air pressure will push in more water to fill that vacuum.
Yeah.
But
it only works up
to a certain point because of how strong air pressure is. It's about 30, 35 feet. Beyond that, air pressure isn't strong enough to push the water up and your siphon won't flow.
But you could think about that. You also point out you could get your water by making it. How would you make that much water?
Well, if you can combine, water is H2O, hydrogen and oxygen. And if you combine the two, if you combine hydrogen, oxygen, and heat, it undergoes a reaction that produces water as one of the outputs. This reaction, though, is the same thing that powers rockets. So it also produces, it becomes self-sustaining and produces a lot of heat. In other words, there's a giant fire. So if you want to make water this way, you put a bunch of hydrogen, a bunch of oxygen together, you got to be very careful or you're just going to create a giant explosion.
Every time you listen to KCUR, you learn something. We hope you're learning something today here, whether it's about a national strike that's affecting local workers or how to dig holes with vacuums. We'll talk about that in a moment, which we'll learn about more here in just a little bit. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. My guest is Randall Monroe, author of How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. He's also the author of What If and Thing Explainer. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, go to rainydaybooks.com. You know, you also tackle in this book this idea of crossing a river, and you get into this idea by talking about using a bicycle or a motorcycle to do it. Walk us through that. I mean, what's possible, because you never know when you might need to cross a river using a motorcycle, Randall.
Well, one of my birthday twins, a celebrity who I share a birthday with, is the motorcycle stuntman, Evel Knievel.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And so we were both born on October 17th. And so I always liked reading about him as a kid. And he would jump across all kinds of really wide gaps on motorcycles. And Getting across the gap is sort of straightforward physics. You know, you've got to go a certain speed, and at that speed, you hit a jump, you can clear a certain distance.
Right.
But the real problem is that it's not the best river crossing or bridge crossing method because, Mr. Knievel, I think, I don't know how many bones he broke in his life, reports differ, but it might be more than he had successful river jumps, more broken bones than successful jumps.
Yeah.
So I actually thought it might be good to pick a river that's a little too wide for you. Because that way, at least you could land in the water, might be a little bit safer.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Can a motorcycle, if you go at it fast enough, straight enough, can you go across a river on a motorcycle?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of viral videos of people going across the water running on a motorcycle, on a bicycle, on jet ski, or on the dirt, all kinds of vehicles. Some of those videos are fake. A person running with their feet, no matter how fast they are, how good their shoes are, can't run across the surface of the water. Ditto for a bicycle. Bicycles won't do that either. But motorcycles have big flat tires. If it's one of those, especially if you do a little bit of modification, you can actually do this. And there's a couple of people online who you can find who have pulled this off and gone motorcycling across the ocean surface.
The other thing you point out is that, hey, if you got to get across the river, one way you could do it safely is if you could freeze the river. What ideas do you have for freezing the river?
Well, it's amazing how much energy it takes to turn water from into ice, or to turn ice, to water. There's a huge amount of energy that goes back and forth there.
Right.
And so I worked out that if you wanted to freeze an entire river, flowing, or freeze a, layer enough to walk across, the amount of energy it would take would mean that you'd have to have a second river of gasoline coming in just to run the compressors to cool the water down. So it would take a river of gasoline that was like comparable in size to the actual river of water. So that's probably not a practical solution.
What about using a kite? That might be a little more reasonable here, you point out.
Yeah, there are kites that can pick people up, although it's pretty dangerous. But, you know, there are human lifting kites. And using a kite to get across a river actually has a history to it. One of the first bridges they did across just below Niagara Falls, they needed to get a line across, but the gorge was too wide.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, and so they held, and, you know, usually they'd shoot it across using an arrow. But it was too wide to cross that way. But they needed a rope across to get the bridge started, you know, to pull the first cables across.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a kite flying contest where they had local kids come and on both sides of the gorge spent a few days flying kites, trying to get a string tangled on the far side. And eventually this teenager named Homan Walsh got his kite across and won the $5 or $10 prize. And that's how the bridge got started.
An example of how practical science can really help.
Exactly. I thought that was ridiculous. And then I was looking it up and found, no, this has actually been done. They didn't send a person across, but it was still, it got the bridge going, and then they used the bridge to get across.
What thoughts do you have on the challenge of moving from one city to another? I mean, you point out that a person could carry all of his or her possessions from one city to the next, but you don't see that very often.
Yeah. You usually see people put things into boxes and then put those boxes in a vehicle of some kind. But to me, packing was always such a hassle. You know,
yes.
It takes so long and so much work that I would think, is there any way I can avoid having to put all my stuff into boxes?
And then, one way to do that is to pick up the whole house, right?
Yeah, I figured you see that sometimes. You'll see houses being carried on flatbed trucks on the road. And so I got to learn about, like, how do you do that? How do you lift a house? Usually you take all the stuff out before you do it, put it on the truck. But if you really wanted to avoid packing, conceivably, you could just leave everything in there and just make sure the truck is big enough to hold it.
Yeah. Does that happen? Do people leave all their possessions in a house and the whole house gets picked up?
You know, I don't think that's very common, especially because if you don't have your bookcases anchored to the walls, they can tip over. And then you got more work cleaning that up. And especially if you've got any valuable, porcelain or something on the bookcases. You can see why people tend to put things in boxes.
But this is the one where you talk about putting things in boxes and putting the boxes in front of a big truck and the truck just pushing the stuff across the state. What's wrong with just putting the stuff in the back of the truck?
Well, this is probably why people put stuff in the truck, you know, is I thought, okay, you got all your stuff in boxes. How do you get it there? And I kind of started from scratch and said, well, you can push the boxes, but then that'll wear away the bottom of the box. And that's why you want to put them on a carrier of some kind.
Yeah. What about lifting an entire house with a powerful helicopter? You addressed this a little bit here, but what thoughts do you have there?
Well, I was thinking that I learned from a friend of mine who worked at a permitting office that people don't know if you want to drive on the highway, you got to get those wide load permits.
Yeah.
And she said in her jurisdiction, you had to get one for every town you passed through. And that seemed like a lot of work to me. So, of course, I started thinking, how can you get around this? And I thought, well, if you get high up enough into the air, then the individual towns, you're not in their jurisdiction. You just got to deal with the FAA. So if you can get a permit from them, you could maybe fly your house that way. But I learned there are no heavy lift helicopters heavy to lift kind of a typical suburban home, even a small one. So I had to think of other ways, you know, by sticking multiple helicopters together or even attaching jet engines to the side of the house.
My guest is Randall Monroe, author of How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems.